Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for August 10, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics, and it's mostly politics tonight and much of it rather gruesome news. In a little bit, we'll listen to an interview I recorded yesterday with Rasha Salty, who is a writer, scholar, and activist in Beirut. I met her when she was here at graduate school at the New School, but she's been in her hometown of Beirut lately, and she's being bombed. And she's written some remarkable dispatches that have circulated around the net and about that experience, both passionate and very intelligent. And so I thought it would be good to get a sample of that passion and intelligence and broadcast it on the radio, which we will hear shortly. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined by the journalist and Christine Dedeschi, who is the author of the book Moving Mountains, The Race to Treat Global AIDS, just out in paperback from Verso, and also director of a film, along with Shanti Aragon and Anne Rossetti, which is called Pills, Profits, and Protest, Chronicle of the Global AIDS Movement. Available on DVD, and we'll get information on all that when Anne Christine Dedeschi joins us in the studio in about half an hour. First, some of the economic headlines. Last Friday brought the big enchilada of economic releases, the July employment report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Once again, a weak jobs report. We've had about three or four of these weak ones in a row. This reporting a gain of just 113,000 jobs in the month. That's less than half the average that we would expect to see in healthy economic expansion. We'd be seeing 250 or 300,000 in a more robust economic expansion, but that's not what we're seeing. This expansion that began in 2001, late 2001, has been characterized by extremely weak employment growth and very poor wage growth. It's been really, really wonderful for profits. People in the upper income brackets have been doing quite well. But most ordinary workers are not getting jobs, and their wages are barely keeping pace with inflation. The unemployment rate jumped from 4.6 to 4.8%. Also, well, while it is low by historical standards, it's certainly going in the wrong direction. And the share of the adult population working fell. It does seem like, as I said, I believe I said last week, that the best days may be behind us in this economic expansion, and this is further evidence of that fact. This morning, the Labor Department, not the Bureau of Labor Statistics, but a sister agency in the Labor Department, reporting that first-time claims for jobless insurance, that is, people who lost their job and went over to the benefits office to sign up, that was up 7,000 in the week, following a 13,000 increase the week before. So that thing working itself a little higher. It has been in good but not great territory, and it's moving a little away from there towards the more mediocre territory. So it does suggest something of a softening job market. The Census Bureau reporting earlier today that international trade, the U.S. running a gigantic trade deficit once again, almost $65 billion last month, by which, rather in the month of June, by which imports exceeded exports. And, of course, every time that is in the red, the U.S. has to borrow the money from abroad to make up the difference. We just sink deeper and deeper into debt, and really no one seems to care. Because it's been going on so long, no one seems to think that there are any serious consequences to running deep into debt. But you have to wonder how that can go on forever, but it has gone on for not quite ever, but for quite a long time. So God smiles on America, I guess. That's the only explanation of what's been going on. The Mortgage Bankers Association reporting earlier in the week that demand for mortgages rose last week. And it does, while that measure has been falling, and other measures of the housing bubble show that is now a defunct housing bubble. It is now leaking air in a major way, but a little bounce in mortgage applications. And just looking at the British housing market, which in many ways is a few years ahead of ours and maybe a precedent for what happened here, it was very exuberant in 2003, 2004, and then the authorities started raising interest rates. The housing market fell apart in Britain, knocked the stuffing out of retail sales and consumption, and slowed down economic growth. But Then when interest rates stabilized after about a year or so, housing reaccelerated. So it's really hard to dampen the speculative spirits of the house buyer, at least in Britain. And if we see that happen here, then it could provoke quite a dilemma for the policymakers because who wants to create unemployment to stop a housing bubble? But that is about the only weapon they've got these days. The Federal Open Market Committee, the policy-setting arms of the Federal Reserve, meeting the other day and not raising interest rates for the first time in 17 meetings. They've raised interest rates 17 consecutive times. They meet every 6 weeks or so to mull over policy, and they've been tightening. Now they're just going to hang back and see what happens. They're convinced the economy is going to slow down, that inflationary pressures will ease, and they're not doing anything, although they say should inflation rear its hideous head, they will be back with more tightening, so we shall see. But that increase in the unemployment rate that mentioned a few minutes ago is just the kind of thing that the Federal Reserve likes to see. They generally don't stop tightening and don't turn around and start lowering interest rates until the unemployment rate has risen, sometimes significantly. So that piece of the puzzle dropping into place. And so we'll see what happens in the coming months. Consumer attitude is deteriorating, according to the weekly measure from the ABC News and Washington Post. That measure had been rising. It took a steep dive from March through May, rose from May through July, now is working its way downward again. So it does seem like gasoline prices, higher gasoline prices, political discontent, weakening job market, all these things taking those tolls on consumer attitudes. Although people still keep spending money, even though they profess to be slightly gloomy. And remarkably, even though gas prices are incredibly high and people are telling some people are telling pollsters that they're cutting back on driving, it's not visible in the demand statistics. People just keep paying up at the pump and driving, and I guess it's going to take $5 gas to slow people down. And that's it. Let's take a little musical break, and I will be back to introduce Rasha Salty. And at the first minute of Christoph Penderecki's Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima, I thought since this show is mostly about war and disease, it was kind of hard to find some appropriate music. But and since we're also about four days after the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, that seemed like pretty appropriate music, performed by the National Polish Radio Symphony Orchestra, directed by Antoni Witt. And we'll hear some more excerpts of that later in the show. A piece written in 1959, the pinnacle of socialist modernism, I guess, in Poland. Very strange piece. Uses quarter tones, and string players play on using the back of the bow and behind the bridge and do all kinds of funny things. And creates a remarkable sound. And we'll hear more of that at the half hour and at the end of the show. And now, an interview I recorded yesterday with Rasha Salty, who is a journalist, a scholar, and a political activist who grew up in Beirut. I met her when she was here in New York City going to graduate school at the New School, but now she has been back in Beirut, and she is filing some remarkable reports emailed around to her acquaintances that made their way all around the Internet, and I thought it was worth giving her a call for an up-close report of what's going on in Lebanon, what it's like to be in Beirut, what she and her fellow Lebanese make of what's going on, what Israel is up to, etc. So let's listen to Rasha Salty.
tell us first what's been happening in Beirut lately. Are you under bombing?
Yes, there was a shelling of another the neighborhood in the southern suburb that was shelled 2 days ago. There were two rounds of shelling late this afternoon. But the south has been shelled nonstop. Tyre and Palestinian camp south of Tyre and the villages surrounding Tyre. And reports, very, very immediate reports, say that the Israeli ground force is beginning to move in, has crossed the border, and is beginning to move inside the territory after the defense, after the Israeli cabinet decision to engage in massive ground offensive.
How do you and your neighbors see what's going on? What is Israel trying to do, attacking civilian targets, destroying the industrial infrastructure? On the face of it, it makes no military or political sense.
You know, yes, it's, that's absolutely true. It's the U.S. media and Israel has been insisting on describing this as their war against Hezbollah. And but you know, the infrastructure of the country has been hit, civilian populations have been hit, even the industrial infrastructure of this country has been targeted. So people experience it here as a war against Lebanon. You know, when they drop flyers and leaflets, and now they've been calling on cell phones and sending text messages to the Lebanese. They come from Israel, and they basically say, oh, Hassan Nasrallah is your enemy like ours. You know, Hezbollah is doing this to you, not us. You know, always trying to emphasize that that is their, it's a war against Hezbollah, not against Lebanon. But that's not the practical experience, of course.
Well, and Hezbollah itself is deeply rooted in southern Lebanon. It's not some external force that just plopped in the territory, is it?
Absolutely not. I mean, Hezbollah is actually a nationwide party. I mean, their constituency, I mean, you know, they are a sectarian party, so they are a party that represents the Shia sect or confessional group. But their constituency is located in the Bekaa Valley, in South Lebanon, in Beirut, and, you know, there are pockets in the north as well.
What has the evolution of popular attitudes towards Hezbollah been? It was not universally admired at first, was it?
Lebanese politics are complicated. Hezbollah have been regarded always with, with a measure of respect because of all the sectarian, of all the political parties that represent a confessional group. Their program of social services has been stellar. And they have, they seem like a political party that serves the interests of their constituency very well. So that's always been identified. Also, in the experience of the post-war, Hezbollah have taken, took a distance from direct engagement with government. They were in parliament, but they were never in the cabinet, and they were never interested they never integrated into the system of corruption. So basically, whatever highway was built, they never took, a cut from the budget, etc. So there's also that other aura that they have not been corrupted, basically, by Lebanese politics. And then, in the year 2000, when Israel pulled out, that was regarded as one of Hezbollah's victories. And that's when Hezbollah became, accepted widely in the country as the national resistance. Not just an Islamic resistance, but as the political, organized, military, political force that expelled the Israeli occupation. But nobody regards them as foreigners or as terrorists. I mean, this language comes from outside. It's not our experience.
What about the politics of the organization? Is it the kind of theocratic formation that a lot of people portray it as?
You know, it's a very funny a political animal, and I very often cite it as an example when people are referring to Islamist groups, partly because of their inherent nature, they start from Shia ideology, and one of the virtues of Shia ideology as opposed to Sunni is that they are the ability to interpret and to adapt, etc., is far more flexible. Hezbollah started as a small armed group that basically had an agenda that was violent, that wanted to establish an Islamic Republic in Lebanon, etc. Very quickly, however, very quickly they realized it wasn't feasible. And very quickly Hezbollah integrated into Lebanese society, into Lebanese polity, and they have become just another political actor on the scene. They are very tolerant. They have never tried to convert, you know, they don't have these like mass conversions things. They don't try to turn people into Shia, for example. They don't force their ideology onto those who do not wish, who are not apt or who do not endorse it. And they are actually quite an interesting model of coexistence. And even in the, I mean, we used to joke during the post-war period, like in the 1996 parliamentary elections, that they were born from the vestiges of the left and of the PLO. And we used to joke and say, Hezbollah means party of God in Arabic. And we used to joke that and say that if you remove God and put communists, if you look at their program, it could, you know, it very well could have been the program of the Communist Party, because it has such a strong social justice component to it, such a strong you know, egalitarian economic development kind of vocabulary and aspect to it. Their constituency is a poor constituency, is a poor working class, and the petite bourgeoisie, and they were able to secure and fight for social wages, for, you know, for they've always had this in the debates in this country. They've always behaved like a leftist group, actually, not like an Islamist group. They don't intervene with, they don't try to ban films. They don't care about the books that are in this country. You know, they don't care about, you know, pornography or whatever. I mean, they do care, but they don't try to fight these fights in the parliament, like if you compare them to the Muslim Brotherhood in Jordan or in Egypt. You know, who try to impose a rigid conservative values on the rest of society.
In one of your dispatches, you said that as a secular egalitarian Democrat, you felt there was really no force that was expressing your kinds of politics. You sound a little friendlier to Hezbollah now than you did when you wrote that.
No, you know what? I hate them with a passion. I mean, I don't like. You know, first of all, they are they cater to a sect. I mean, they start from a sectarian principle, which I utterly, totally reject, absolutely. And then, you know, they are and they endorse an Islamist ideology. That is something I cannot accept, absolutely. But what I'm trying to, I mean, what happened to me now. In this, you know, it's kind of like the Muslim cartoons controversy in Denmark. You know, I mean, we are cornered, and every time I am interpolated, I am supposed to give an interview to the West, I have to go through this litany to explain to people that, you know, this is not Al Qaeda. This is not the language of the war on terror has, I think, shrouded people's minds. Blocks their ability to do, you know, appropriate interpretation and analysis. I am absolutely not a proponent of Hezbollah, but I said it also in that same blog that you referred to. If the attempt is to take down Hezbollah, I will go down with it, because they are an integral part of this country. They represent a huge constituency, a huge population. I refuse. I mean, this is how we are plural in Lebanon, and this is how we are democratic in Lebanon. We accept one another. They will never represent me, and I want to fight with them in parliament and in local city councils. But when we are hunted down and burned like this, I mean, yeah, I might sound like I endorse them.
I'm speaking with Rasha Salty, who is a freelance journalist, scholar, and political activist in Beirut.
What about the relation to Iran? Here they're portrayed as the puppets of Iran. Is that the way they're perceived in Lebanon?
You know, again, Lebanon is a very small country, very complicated, absolutely not amusing, and never easy to explain. So, yes, there is a definite connection to Iran. If you listen to the way the Hezbollah spokesperson presented, they say it's a strategic alliance. I, for one, you know, for somebody who has grown up here, who has lived and witnessed the emergence of this political movement, it's much more than a strategic alliance. Now, the extent to which they are a pawn of Iran is another question. You know, I mean, that, I think, is up for grabs. My gripe with Hezbollah throughout the post-war has been that they have often placed the interests of their Syrian patron or mentor or whatever ally and their Iranian ally to a far much farther extent before Lebanese interests. I think Hezbollah have tremendous power in Lebanon that they never needed to behave, to comply to Syria's whims like the way they did. And that was one of the reasons, you know, I was, that was one of my problems that was one of the reasons I would be angry with Hezbollah. Now, today, I think the situation is changing a little bit. I don't think this is an Iranian war or a war against Iran. This is a war against Lebanon. And this is a war that's being, you know, genuinely and to a very large extent, you know, fought on the Lebanese border. This is not about the Iranian nuclear weapons. However, this, you know, this war is happening in a regional context, and I'm sure the, you know, the regional powers are at play in this field. I am hoping, my hope is that Hezbollah will emerge much more self-confident and much more powerful, and basically be able to shrug off being a pawn of Syria or being giving away so much of its power to Syria.
How do Lebanese see the role of the United States? Does it see Israel acting on U.S. behalf, Israel acting on its own, joint venture between the two, or how is it perceived?
You know, there are a few polls that came out, and they claim that there is 88% support among the Lebanese population for the what they call now the resistance instead of saying Hezbollah. I think there is, to a very far extent, a rallying in defense of Lebanon. And I think in that rallying you find shades. You know, some people see the United States as the big enemy. And amongst those people, this war is mostly perceived, and this is the first time that it's happening in the region, that now Israel is a pawn of the United States. We've always perceived the opposite, that the United States has been a pawn in the hands of Israel. Now it's the opposite. And there were some echoes of that in the Israeli press. But there is a portion of this population, of the Lebanese population, that feels, and especially the people behind, you know, the March 14th movement, the March 14th being the day when there was a mass mobilization that demanded that Syria leave the country, etc. These people feel that the Americans who promoted Lebanon as a democracy, who, you know, sang the praises of this new government, etc., have been let down. And historically, Lebanon has been let down by the United States. So these people are now, you know, basically awakening from, feel like they were the butt of a joke, you know, that the Americans used them when they wanted and discarded them when they had no longer any use for them.
How does Iraq figure in this? Is this perceived as perhaps an extension of the war in Iraq, or is that...
You know, this is very interesting. Iraq is perceived as the terrain where the U.S. is falling flat on its face, where U.S. Foreign policy, U.S. defense policy is creating a hell for an entire nation, and where the U.S. cannot see the light at the end of the tunnel. Most people believe here that Iraq is a new Vietnam for the U.S., an entirely different kind of Vietnam, but certainly a new Vietnam. And it's an unfortunate, I mean, it's horrific because it's creating a chaos in the region. With this war and with the rise and emergence of Hassan Nasrallah as an icon, as a Shia icon, as an Arab icon, as the new general, if you want, the only Arab general who could stand at par with Israel, the only Arab general who has a disciplined army that no one can see, that can send most of the northern Israeli population down to the shelter. So he's this icon. In Iraq, the Shia population is mostly pro-American or is allied to the American, or at least the opposition to the American presence has been staunchly Sunni. There is now beginning, you can feel the beginnings of a sea change. On Hezbollah TV, you can find late at night, they have now a new section in their news where they document and report Shia military operations conducted against the U.S. by Shia groups. So it's not, the army of the Mahdi, but they are smaller groups. And they show actually videos of how they blow up tanks and how they, whatever, place bombs, etc. Last weekend, Saturday or Sunday, there was a massive, massive protest in Baghdad in support of Hassan Nasrallah. And this could turn, this is one of the things that might indicate, that might be a consequence of what the way Hezbollah has been able to stand up to Israel in the region, meaning the Americans might find themselves more and more in trouble in Iraq with a Shia population empowered, and inspired to resist.
What is daily life in Beirut now like? I was just reading that fuel is running low and electricity may disappear in the next several days. Can people get on with their lives, or is it totally disrupted?
No, it's totally disrupted. I mean, in the first 2 weeks, it was changed. But at this stage, it's coming very close. Banks are open. Offices function at half-day schedules. But the electricity is a real problem. And the shortage is very serious. The shortage is nationwide, not just in the capital. People's movement has been furthermore restricted. The American University Hospital, I think, is running out of fuel and is calling out for help or something. I mean, there are appeals you get all the time, about hospitals, etc. But the fact that the American University Hospital should be running low on its fuel reserves is fairly alarming. It's by far one of the largest hospitals and the most specialized. And, they thought they could have some sort of a break because they are the American University Hospital. I don't know if they're going to get a break. Every day we are told that we're going to get fuel, but it hasn't happened so far.
And then finally, you're involved in organizing a massive march of people from Beirut southwards. Tell us about that.
Yes, it's sounding more and more insane with this ground invasion coming up, but it's an initiative that was born amongst a group of NGOs. There are 1 million displaced people from the south and from the Bekaa. Because their homes have been destroyed or because they've been terrorized and forced to flee. And so these 1 million people are camped, a large number is camped in Beirut. They've been placed in schools and in government buildings, but also they're spread in the country. And these people have been tended to by the NGOs. So the civil society has been actually conducting the civil resistance, much more so than the government. And this initiative was born amongst the NGOs. The idea is to basically break the siege and defy Israel's directives to prevent people from going south. So it is the launch of this campaign, and it's being called the Lebanese Civilian Resistance, is on August 12th. There is a convoy of cars that is preparing to go south. It is not clear yet, they have not yet determined the final point of their destination. They are not suicidal, so they don't want to go someplace where they were all going to die. They have a lot of wonderful support from internationals that have come. Americans, actually, quite a few Americans and Europeans and Latin Americans and Asians. They are streaming in, as best they can, and they're hoping to go south to make a political statement, but also to deliver aid to those people who are under siege. When the International Red Cross or the UN try to deliver food, they have to coordinate with Israel. So basically, so they have to wait for permission, otherwise, they get shelled, and oftentimes they have been shelled. So there are places that have been completely isolated, and the idea is to go to these places that have been completely isolated.
And that's the voice of Rasha Salty, who is a journalist, scholar, and political activist in Beirut. An interview I recorded with her yesterday. Let's take a little station break, and we'll be back with Anne-Christine Dudesky.
This is Lawrence Block, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City. Listener-supported and non-commercial.
And this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 on the FM dial and at WBAI.org on the web. My name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. And let's listen to a little bit more of the threnody for the victims of Hiroshima and bring on Anne-Christine Dudesky. And that, a minute or so from the middle of Krzysztof Penderecki's Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima, performed by the National Polish Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Anthony Witt. And now we're joined in the studio by Anne-Christine Dudesky, who is the author of the book Moving Mountains, The Race to Treat Global AIDS, out in paperback from Versa with a new afterword, and also one of the directors of a film called Pills, Profits, and Protest, Chronicle of the Global AIDS Movement. About which we'll get ordering information as we move along. I think for a lot of Americans, they've forgotten about AIDS. It just doesn't really, it doesn't have the salience in the public mind that it did. Obviously, AIDS has done anything but gone away. So give us some sense of the scope around the world.
Well, I think it's important for us to focus on the difference between the epidemic in other parts of the world and here, because I think that when people realize it, they are getting a sense that it's actually directly impacting us here every day. I mean, the statistics are still something that everyone debates about, whether it's 40 million or 42 million or 46 million. But the bottom line is that for the hardest hit countries, you're talking about countries like Botswana, I mean, the forecasts are literally that these are going to be failed states within a very short period of time if we don't turn this epidemic around. I mean, we're talking about the entire collapse of these economies, and we're already seeing just the most grave situation in terms of the impact on the daily lives of people, so much death, so much illness, and it impacts on the ability of the country to be productive. And we live in a global economy, so if you're seeing sections of Africa that are truly beyond beyond the ability of coming back from such catastrophic forecasts, that's going to be felt here, and in many, many ways that we probably even can't grasp at this moment. But I think in addition to the sort of suffering and level of death that people are obviously aware of when they think about a statistic like 46 million, there's an impact on so many different levels because we are part of this sort of global economy, global culture, global politics.
You say turn it around. How can we do that?
Well, I do feel like we've had a tremendous shift in the public awareness, and I think that is the number one issue that has to happen, public awareness that can lead to action, and action that then translates into funding, that translates into policy. And so in my book and in the movies as well, what I tried to do was start looking at that shift as of 2000, and I gave an update that was just from a few months back now, and so I've generally seen that there's tremendous momentum on the ground. And when you go to countries, you really can't catch your breath because people are racing so quickly to try to deliver a series of initiatives. It's everything from the package of education and prevention and treatment. Obviously, treatment has been the issue that's garnered the most headlines globally. That's the demand. But here in the United States, there's been a lot more focus on prevention because particularly the agenda of the Bush administration and its support more for what people consider to be a far too narrow prevention strategy, which is focusing on abstinence. But at the same time, you know, this virus and this epidemic is moving also extremely quickly. So if you really pull back and you look at the big picture, what you have is the virus and the epidemic are increasing. So we can't say we're winning. On the other hand, you see this tremendous surge of energy, and you see what I think to be a really positive thing happening, which is movements coming together, social change movements coming together. In other words, AIDS cross-cutting across issues, whether it's globalization, whether it's human rights, whether it's women's rights, whether it's domestic violence. All of it is something that lies underneath the AIDS epidemic because it's ultimately a socioeconomic problem.
You mentioned the Bush administration and their abstinence obsession. How influential is that? Is it really causing trouble around the world, or is it just a particular obsession that we can forget about?
You know, money talks. And I think the difficulty is that when you are putting most of the money into a policy that is promoting abstinence rather than promoting a broader education or access to condoms, you're impacting on all these levels. What I've seen is that the bottom line is that people can't get money for other things. And so you haven't seen other multi-sector players come in. There's other money that could come in. I mean, if we're so, you know, saying, look, there's other alternatives. I mean, you haven't seen, though, other private money. You haven't seen other really major sources for a more comprehensive package. I think the worst impact, and the thing that I really single out in the book, and I feel very strongly about it, obviously, is that the biggest problem with the focus on abstinence is that it simply doesn't work for the target population that you need to reach. And what we've seen statistically, certainly across sub-Saharan Africa, and this is true in Asia now, we're seeing this in even other countries where they're just really beginning to see the increase of the epidemic, and it's really been married women. And so that's the bottom line. Whether you support abstinence or not, whether you're totally opposed to it, the bottom line is that as a public health strategy, it really becomes moot because these women can't support that policy. The expectation and the cultural expectation, the norm is for these women to, generally, to abstain before they get married. And when they get married, obviously, one of the aspects is, you know, the marital duty or the expectation and the desire to have a family. So what we're seeing is in these countries that often the men don't know that they're particularly exposed to HIV, or they have histories where they haven't had access to the testing, or they may know in some cases. And there's not condoms anyway. You know, the big debate about condoms is, the ironic part is, of course, that there's been so little education around condoms and so little distribution that, you know, you have countries where you have such a little use of condoms that taking condoms off the menu, I mean, it has an impact, but it's not as if a lot of men were using those condoms in the first place. The problem is the whole piece of education that came with a more comprehensive approach. So what I'm seeing, and it's just, you know, it's heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking, is these great numbers of very young women who have abstained, gotten married, having their first child, and finding out that they're HIV positive. And, you know, feeling like these policies, these global policies, which are now being adopted, like, you know, Uganda being the sort of model. You know, when I was looking at it in 2000, 2001, 2002, and I wrote about this in the book, I said, you know, I don't think it's going to work. I think we're going to see an increase. We're going to see it backfire, and it's going to be something that we should be able to document in the cost of human lives. And that's what's happened. We've seen in the last few months, finally, the statistics emerging showing that Uganda is now going in a reverse trend after years of being a poster child for prevention because they adopted a national policy, essentially, of supporting abstinence. And, you know, we have to call them out on that, and we should be, as Americans, making a lot of noise about saying that we can't have our dollars going to that. It comes out of our pockets. You know, we have a right to say something about it.
When in Esther Kaplan's book, In a Christian Right, she writes about the abstinence thing and points out that when the Christians are shown that this stuff doesn't work, they don't care. They're not interested in empirical reality because they've got access to a higher truth, I guess.
Well, the other thing about abstention is that I always do try to make this point, because I think that I'm coming really from a perspective of seeing the disempowerment of women in a lot of these places, is that, you know, I do like to say that as a progressive person and as a journalist, as somebody documenting this, as a public health person, that I support, and I think that we should support, you know, the right of a woman to abstain from sex. There's a lot of these women who want to be able to abstain from sex in certain circumstances. That's not the issue. The issue is this is absolutely failing, and it's failing women as well as men. I mean, men are in a crisis, too. They have no tools available to them. If they are HIV positive, they have nothing that they can use to be able to try to protect themselves, whether they're married or not, if condoms have been taken off the menu.
Now, what about the drug treatment? When the drug treatments, which have been remarkably effective, but when they first came on the market, the price tags were like $10,000 a year. You write in the book that treatment now can be gotten for as low as 38 cents a day.
Mm-hmm.
How did we get from $10,000 a year to 38 cents a day, which is a decline of like, what, 99% or something like that?
Well, I think we need to say, where is that accessible? I mean, here in the United States, $10,000 is actually not the highest price tag you can now pay for drugs, because those were for the drugs, the first-line drugs being used. And what I do talk about in the afterword in this new update is that, you know, you would think that after all this pressure, the big drug companies had really learned a lesson, had sort of been smacked down in certain ways to be able to say they don't want to have the same profile. Bottom line is that the most of the newest drugs that have come out, for particularly for people who are resistant, right, to all these first-line drugs. In other words, you've been sick a while, you've been taking these drugs, they've been working, but you've become resistant. You may have been taking the drugs absolutely perfectly, but it's a Darwinian thing. There's a certain evolution of the virus in response to treatment. So you become resistant, you need access to a second-line therapy or substitute therapy. These new drugs have set a ceiling, a record high in their class. Each of the drugs that have come out a second record ceiling for their high price tag. In other words, they're trying to get as much money as they possibly can, make as much profit still, and they're making on the backs of the people who are actually the sickest, the people who actually need alternative drugs. So that really just reveals to you that, you know, we have to maintain incredible pressure. I do see some progress in the sense that 38 cents a day drugs, these are now generic drugs. That's essentially for the least developed countries, where these drug companies, the bigger drug companies in the first place, they weren't really marketing. They'd already decided that that wasn't really a worthwhile market for them. It only represents 1% of the global drug, you know, sales. But at this point, you do see, for example, in the last 2 weeks or so, we've seen an announcement from Gilead that's been in the news recently. I wrote recently about Gilead in the San Francisco Chronicle, sort of an editorial saying, you know, there's a lot of activist criticism because Gilead's drugs, while they look great and they could help for people who are resistant, they're not available. Why not? What's the lag? And it's a bunch of different things. But one of the things is that there's still this issue of using patents to protect your markets, particularly the markets in the middle-tier countries and the markets in the first countries, the U.S., Western Europe, etc. So what Gilead has done in India, it's very interesting, and they're being criticized for this for different reasons, but they've decided to go ahead and say, we want to have our patent in a middle-tier country like India. But they've also decided to give the license then to 6 or 8 Indian companies, generic companies, in order to have them bring the price down so that competition between the generic companies will bring it to the lowest price. In the meantime, Gilead still gets their profit. So I think that that's what we're going to see in the next year, more and more of the big pharma companies deciding to license and do this kind of competition among the generics. But at the same time, you still have, you know, the ultimate picture being that people who got access to those really cheaper drugs 2 and 3 years ago are now needing second-line drugs, and they're not available. And you have just this catastrophic picture with pediatric drugs, you know, where you essentially have, because of the unwillingness of 3 of the companies who all hold patents on a pediatric drug, they don't want to work with each other to make the drug available in a combination pill for an infant in a liquid formula, because it would mean giving up some part of their profit to put that pill together. And as a result, all over the world, we have millions of kids who are unable to get access to these drugs because they can't take these adult pills that have to be, you know, broken down and chewed up. And it's just unbelievable. It's really just heartbreaking, as I said.
It's the voice of Anne-Christine Donesky, who is the author of Moving Mountains, the global race to treat global AIDS, just out in paperback from Verso. Drug patents is really a very sensitive issue politically. The Bush administration, of course, very close to the pharmaceutical industry. The U.S. historically, going back into the Clinton administration as well, has been very obsessed with intellectual property rights and international trade negotiations. So this is something that U.S. capital and the U.S. state want to protect very intensely. How successful have activists been at breaching those defenses?
Well, I think that the international, the activists, different types of activists, you have the globalization activists, everything from the Battle for Seattle on to the AIDS activists, have been quite successful in making people aware of what the impact of these trade laws are, what the impact of free trade is, for example, on access to essential things like water, like these essential drugs. And we've seen in the AIDS...
I should point out the free traders of the 18th and 19th century didn't believe in patents and copyright. But
exactly.
Their successors in the 21st are very intensely devoted to it.
You know, what I see is I see a great awakening that's happened in the media, as well as that's come from the activist movement. I see more working together, although I do think that these movements tend to be too narrowly focused and don't work together enough. One of the things, though, that I think is really important that's emerged out of the AIDS field, and this has been specifically around these drugs, is that for the first time, people are saying, you know what, this system really doesn't work. Not only should we not have essential drugs, life-saving drugs, be put to market forces like this because they're not going to give access to global public, to the global public that's going to be poor, but that the system right now is set up in a way where these drug companies charge so much because they say that they're needing to reap back the money that they put into what they're calling the innovation, the R&D, the research and development, which is, in fact, for many of the AIDS drugs, not true at all. Really what they do is they buy the drugs. Once they've been, you know, developed by biotech companies and they've shown to be successful, they do pay a lot of money to get them tested and put them through clinical trials, and then they sink all their money into the marketing, which is why you get these $10,000, you know, price tags, when in reality the drugs can be made for pennies, which is what the generic companies reveal, right? So there are groups like, for example, Jamie Love at CP Tech, Consumer Protection Against Technology, Project and Technology. He is kind of, you know, comes out of the Nader camp, and he has been putting forward some very good ideas for different ways in which we can reward innovation that maybe come from things like a foundation sources or government sources, in which by the time that compound shows a promise, then a drug company can buy it and market it. But they can't put the same price tag on it because they haven't had this mysterious huge amount of money they've sunk into R&D. So I've already seen that. For example, if you look at the development of AIDS vaccines, that system is in place, that kind of approach. And so I really believe that we can see that there's been a greater engagement of civil societies in the fact that we have to kind of have a different system for the, essentially the development and the marketing and the, you know, ultimately the delivery of what we consider to be these essential goods that are really the human right of every person, whether it's water, whether it's medicine. So I see that as extremely promising, and I do think that we'll see more and more of this in the next 5 years, 10 years, to the point where we will have a different system later.
You mentioned a different system. You've got a chapter on Cuba in the book, and Cuba attracted a lot of attention at first in the early days of the AIDS crisis for confining people in sanatoriums with people with AIDS. What are they up to now? How have they dealt with the problem?
Well, I think that Cuba has done extremely good things, and there's some things that are really to be criticized still. I think that one of the things they did was they took a really, quote, classic public health approach, almost like a quarantine approach to HIV in the beginning, like it did to TB and other types of drugs. What I think is really innovative about what Cuba did is that they have with essentially kind of a family approach to public health and medicine. So they have these teams that are small, and they decentralize the system so that you have a little team of a nurse, a doctor, and a social worker that's essentially responsible for providing coverage to X number of people in a community. And so it really means that you have this decentralized local delivery of health, which I think is a terrific model. It's proven itself. And so people in Cuba have been able to get access to many of the first-line drugs. The problem comes in again where, for different reasons, Cuba hasn't necessarily been able to make the second-line drugs. So you have people in Cuba who are not getting access to those second-line drugs. They're still going to be at risk of being very ill or dying if they can't get access to them. So, you know, I think that Cuba has been remarkably innovative in how it's prioritized medicine overall. I mean, there's doctors in Cuba that are being exported all over the place because they've made this a priority. I think the big question is, okay, if Castro dies, if the situation is going to change, what may happen in Cuba with regard to something like the AIDS epidemic? What's going to happen if you have a different kind of political system come in? And I think that there's a bunch of different possibilities. But one of the things is certainly that right now, you know, Cubans have put in place a system where they feel like every citizen gets the right to a sort of minimal package of care, which is more than we can say here in the United States with our system. So I hope that they'll be able to hold on to that piece of it. At the same time, if different forces come in, if a market system comes in for some reason after Castro or some kind of combination, that system is used to be able to still, you know, maybe provide competition. But you're likely to see privatization more than you're likely to see a real focus on trying to deliver a better public health system. Hopefully Cuba, you know, there's been a lot of Cubans involved in their system. It hasn't just been Castro. It's been an entire country for many, many years. So all those people who have seen how it can deliver are going to want to improve what's worked, and maybe seeing what's not worked, try to improve on that too.
Cubans, for a poor country, have a pretty advanced biotechnology sector. Have they done any drug development in the area?
They have. I mean, they haven't done a lot of research, but they've been producing generic AIDS drugs. They've been producing successful ones. They've done malaria and vaccine research. They've done some good things in terms of the research. I think where they're extremely strong, honestly, is in the whole field of what we consider to be tropical medicine. And really focusing on the diseases that are endemic, that they then have been able to really focus on. How do you put in the delivery system? And a lot of it's really just focused on grassroots health. They've looked at their population as a population that has limited access to resources, and they've tried to see how to work with that. And so a lot of the models are, how do you deliver in rural health situations? There's a lot of great innovation that's come from Cuba.
We're speaking with Anne-Christine Dedeschi, who is the author of Moving Mountains, the Race to Treat Global AIDS, recently out in paperback from Verso. The Bush administration grabbed some headlines with some funding for the Global AIDS Initiative. Is there any there?
I think there is there. The problem is, how much more could be there, and what's it not doing? We've already talked a little bit about prevention. They've earmarked so much of this money to go to prevention, and it's been abstinence, that you have to really ask whether or not that is going to deliver in terms of improved health. And there's a lot of criticism. I think the problem when people look at the money is that they tend to be very monolithic in terms of looking at something like PEPFAR money, which is the name of the program. If you go on the ground in different countries, you actually see a very different picture in different countries. It reflects, you know, who's delivering, what the agencies are that have received the money, what their abilities are. So you see a different picture. But really, the biggest problem is that the bulk of the money didn't go in to provide a comprehensive health package, and therefore we've lost an opportunity. And also, initially, at least for quite a long time, these drugs were used to buy the brand name drugs. So that they were paying a lot more for drugs when they could have been paying for generic drugs, and so that money didn't go very far.
Right.
You know, so but PEPFAR, in its you always have to look. I rarely see it black or white. I see generally this kind of gray, where you see some very good things and some terrible things. Very good things are that it's raised a lot of awareness. You have, wherever you have these things go in, they still are going to raise, they're going to engage people. And so you have debates that happen. You have debates that happen about abstinence, and ultimately that causes you to have a debate about a very taboo subject, which is sexuality. You have a debate about sex work because they don't want to pay for programs that support sex work. And you start having a discussion about what are the needs of sex workers in that country. So there's always going to be some positive things that come from something that's very controversial.
And speaking of money, what about Bill Gates and his money? Is that being well spent in your opinion?
I do think that the Gates money has gone to some good things, particularly because they're now focusing essentially also on some neglected diseases like the malaria and sleeping sickness and, different river blindness. I mean, these things that really affect global public health. I also think that one of the appeal to the vanity of the big business titans is interesting. You now see others saying that they want to be seen as the guy who's backing global philanthropy. So, I think Bill Gates has given a sort of face to a new role for American private sector money that should care about the global AIDS epidemic, because it's having an incredible impact on global business.
And Bill Clinton's foundation is also involved, right? What are they up to?
The Clinton Foundation initially was really involved in particularly providing technical assistance for things like procurement and delivery of the health system, trying to really work with government to improve their health systems. Some of the people who worked for them helped to write national plans for governments to deliver. Where I work in Rwanda, I'm working with a project called We Act, and we're helping genocide and rape survivors. And I started that after the book. So that's a project in which Rwanda, the Clinton Foundation, has been pretty active. They've really teamed with government to try to help around training, try to help broker lower prices for tests, diagnostic tests, pediatric drugs, things like that. So it's problem solving, and I think that they've done really good things with their money. I think that just having Clinton involved obviously really raises the profile, and people want to be next to that kind of celebrity and that kind of power, so you can use it well. I would love to see Clinton get involved in the issue of HIV in women. That would be my dream. If he could start talking about HIV in women, I think that would be fantastic.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, so tell us about Pills, Profits, and Protests, the film that you're involved in making.
Well, Pills, Profits is a companion very much to the book. It was written on the back of the book in a way. I went there, and then I brought some filmmakers. Really, at that time, we were seeing this movement was starting, and I felt it was really important to document it. I feel like we didn't really document as well as we should have the domestic movement here, and I felt like it was exciting to be watching it. So we kind of put it together as it was happening and then realized that we really had a film that showed these really seminal moments of the movement. It's very much a picture of the grassroots activism, the movement taking shape on the ground and really showing, particularly the Brazil model in action, showing what the difference is between a country like Haiti, really showing the face of the generics industry in India. I think it's all exciting. I really do. I feel like the AIDS movement is one of those movements where you feel like, wow, it takes your breath away. You can do a small thing and you have such an impact. It's one of those rare things, I think, when you work in progressive politics and social change, to really feel like you can have a major impact. So it's been very exciting to be involved in that and watch this movement take its shape and really gain its power.
And can people order the DVD?
They can. The distributor is Outcast Films here in New York, and they're on the web, OUTCAST. And it actually, I think both the film and book can be ordered in some way together. So if you decide you want some kind of discount, what I think is good about the film is that we now have a DVD out, and it has a lot of educational materials on it. It's out in four languages, so we can really get it out to more of a global public. It's in Spanish, it's in French. So I think that it finally is an opportunity for people around the world who haven't yet had a chance to really not only see how they're being portrayed, but to be able to educate further about these issues around trade and that they haven't necessarily had in their mainstream media as much as we may have here.
Well, the movement certainly inspiring counter to what could be a very depressing topic. Thanks for joining us. And Christine Dedeschi, who is the author of the book Moving Mountains, The Race to Treat Global AIDS, and also one of the makers of the film Pills, Profits, and Protests, which you can order from Outcast Films, outcast-films.com on the web, outcast-films.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on until the evening. And let's go out with the conclusion of Penderecki's Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima. Till next week. Bye.